Ayrım 8.
Sayfa 81. We do not seek pleasure for the sake of anything further to be got out of it. At the same time, pleasure has characteristics that make it appear not to be a telos. It does not complete or terminate an activity. That is, the pleasure we get from doing something is not a sign that we have reached our goal and should therefore stop. Rather, getting pleasure is a reason for continuing the activity. Moreover, there is no particular action or set of actions which can be specified as ways of getting pleasure. Pleasure comes from many different kinds of activity, and so to say that pleasure was the telos would not of itself ever give us a reason for choosing one of those kinds of activity rather than another. But to do this is the function of a telos. And finally, the pleasure that we take in an activity cannot be identified separately from the activity itself. To enjoy or take pleasure in doing something is not to do something and to have an accompanying experience of something else, which is the pleasure. To enjoy playing a game is not to play the game and in addition to experience some sensations, say, which are the pleasure. To enjoy playing a game is simply to play well and not to be distracted, to be, as we say, thoroughly involved in the game. Thus, we cannot identify pleasure as a telos external to the activity, to which the activity is a means. Pleasure, says Aristotle, in a memorable but unhelpful phrase, supervenes on the telos, like the bloom on the cheek of youth. Different activities, different pleasures. Which activities then? The activities of the good man. But which will these be? If happiness consists in activity in accordance with virtue, it is reasonable that it should be activity in accordance with the highest virtue, and this will be the virtue of what is best in us. What is best in us is reason, and the characteristic activity of reason is theoria, that speculative reasoning which deals with unchanging truths. Such speculation can be a continuous and pleasant. It is, Aristotle says brusquely, the pleasantest form of activity. It is a self-sufficient occupation. It has no practical outcome, so it cannot be a means to anything else. It is an activity of leisure and peacetime, and leisure is the time when we do things for their own sake, since business affairs are for the sake of leisure and war is for the sake of peace. Above all, since it is concerned with what is unchanging and timeless, it is concerned with the divine. Aristotle follows Plato and much else in Greek thought in equating changelessness and divinity. Thus, surprisingly, the end of human life is metaphysical contemplation of truth. The treatise, which began with an attack on Plato's conception of the form of the good, ends not so far away from the same attitude of contempt for the merely human. External goods are necessary only to a limited extent, and the wealth required is only moderate. Thus, the whole of human life reaches its highest point in the activity of a speculative philosopher with a reasonable income. The banality of the conclusion could not be more apparent. Why, then, is it reached? One clue is in Aristotle's concepts of self-sufficiency. A man's activities in his relations with other men are for Aristotle in the end subservient to this. Man may be a social cum political animal, but his social and political activity is not what is central. Yet who can live with this degree of leisure and wealth and this degree of disengagement from affairs outside himself? Clearly, only a few people. This, however, could not appear as an objection to Aristotle. Therefore, it is the nature of the many to be moved by fear, but not a sense of honor, to abstain from what is bad, not on account of its baseness, but for fear of the penalties. For, living on their emotions, they pursue the appropriate pleasures and the means to these pleasures, and avoid the opposite pains, but they lack even a concept of the noble end of true pleasure, never having tasted it. So Aristotle concludes, they could not be attracted or changed by ethical theorizing. The tone is that of Plato's Laws. Aristotle's audience, then, is explicitly a small leisured minority. We are no longer faced with a telos for human life as such, but with a telos for one kind of life, which presupposes a certain kind of hierarchical social order, and which presupposes also a view of the universe, in which the realm of timeless truth is metaphysically superior to the human world of change and sense experience and ordinary rationality. All Aristotle's conceptual brilliance in the course of the argument declines at the end to an apology for this extraordinarily parochial form of human existence. At once the objection will be made. This is to judge Aristotle against the background of our values, not of his. It is to be guilty of anachronism. But this is not true. Socrates had already presented an alternative set of values in both his teaching and his life. Greek tragedy presents other different possibilities. Aristotle did not choose what he chose for lack of knowledge of alternative views of human life. How then are we to understand this union in the ethics of philosophical acumen and social obscurantism? To answer this, we must look at his work in a wider perspective. Chapter 8. Postscript to Greek Ethics. The division of labor and the differentiation of function in early societies produces a vocabulary in which men are described in terms of the roles they fulfill. The use of evaluative words follows hard upon this, since any role can be filled well or ill, and any customary mode of behavior conformed to or broken away from. But evaluation with a wider scope is only possible when traditional role behavior is seen in contrast with other possibilities, and the necessity of choice between old and new ways becomes a fact of social life. It is not surprising, therefore, that it is in the transition from the society which was the bearer of the Homeric poems to the society of the 5th century city-state that good and its cognates acquired a variety of uses, and that it is in the following decades that man reflects self-consciously about those uses. Greek philosophical ethics differs from later moral philosophy in ways that reflect the difference between Greek society and modern society. The concepts of duty and responsibility in the modern sense appear only in germ or marginally. Those of goodness, virtue, and prudence are central. The respective roles of these concepts hinge upon a central difference. In general, Greek ethics asks, what am I to do if I am to fare well? Modern ethics asks, what ought I to do if I am to do right? And it asks this question in such a way that doing right is made something quite independent of faring well. A writer thoroughly imbued with the modern spirit in ethics, the Oxford philosopher H.A. Pritchard, could accuse Plato of falling into error simply by attempting to justify justice at all. Footnote: Does Moral Philosophy Rest on a Mistake? In Mind, 1912, reprinted in Moral Obligation. For to justify justice is to show that it is more profitable than injustice, that it is to our interest to be just. But if we do what is just and right, because it is to our interest, then, so Pritchard takes almost for granted, we are not doing it because it is just and right at all. Morality, indeed, cannot have any justification external to itself. If we do not do what is right for its own sake, and whether it is to our interest or not, then we are not doing what is right. The assumption made by Pritchard is that the notion of what is to our interest, of what is profitable to us, is logically independent of the concept of what it is just and right for us to do. If what is profitable is also just, this, so far as ethics is concerned, is merely coincidental, a happy accident. Doing what we want and getting what we want is one thing, doing what we ought is another. But Pritchard here misses the point not only of Plato, but of the implications of the Greek moral vocabulary which Plato uses. The Greek moral vocabulary is not so framed that the objects of our desires and our moral aims are necessarily independent. To do well and to fare well are found together in a word like eudaimon. From such purely linguistic considerations, of course, little of substance follows. It still remains to ask whether it is modern ethics which is clarifying a valid distinction that the Greek moral vocabulary fails to observe, or Greek ethics which is refusing to make a false and confusing distinction. One way of answering this question would be as follows. Ethics is concerned with human actions. Human actions are not simply bodily movements. We can identify as instances of the same human action deeds which are executed by means of quite different bodily movements, as the movements involved in shaking a hand and those involved in putting out a flag may both be examples of welcoming somebody. And we can identify as the same bodily movements those which exemplify very different actions, as a movement of the legs may be part of running a race or of fleeing in battle. How then do I exhibit a piece of behavior as an action or part of a sequence of actions rather than as mere bodily movement? The answer can only be that it is by showing that it serves a purpose which constitutes part or the whole of the agent's intention in doing what he does. What is more, the agent's purpose is only to be made intelligible as the expression of his desires and aims. Consider now how modern post-Kantian ethics emphasizes the contrast between duty and inclination. If what I do is made intelligible in terms of the pursuit of my desires, if my desires are cited as affording me reasons for doing what I do, it cannot be that in doing what I do, I am doing my duty. Hence, when I am doing my duty, what I do cannot be exhibited as a human action, intelligible in the way that ordinary human actions are. So the pursuit of duty becomes a realm of its own, unconnected with anything else in human life. To this, the reply of a writer like Pritchard would be that indeed this is so, and that to suppose it could be otherwise would be an error. But we can now more fruitfully approach Pritchard's position in another way and exhibit its historical roots. If we do so, we shall see a gradual attenuation of the concept of duty and of kindred concepts, in which there is a progress from a notion of a duty as consisting in the requirement to fulfill a specific role, the fulfillment of which serves a purpose which is entirely intelligible as the expression of normal human desires. Consider the duties of a father, seaman, or doctor as examples. The next step is perhaps the concept of duty as something to be done by the individual, whatever his private desires. Finally, we reach the concept of duty as divorced from desire altogether. If we could not explain Pritchard's concepts of duty historically, I think we should be very much in the position of anthropologists who come across a new and incomprehensible word, such as, for example, taboo, a word which is puzzling because it appears not simply to mean prohibited, but to give a reason for the prohibition without its being clear what reason. So when someone like Pritchard says it is our duty to do something, he does not just tell us to do it as though he uttered an injunction, do that, but he appears to give us a reason. Consequently, just as we may ask of Polynesians why we should refrain from doing something because it is taboo, so we shall want to ask Pritchard why we should do something because it is our duty. And in each case, the answer will be similar and similarly incomprehensible. Because it is taboo, because it is our duty. The lack of connection with other aims, purposes, and desires produces in the end unintelligibility. Yet the concept which Pritchard elucidates is one in common use. Why ought I to do that? You just ought, is not uncommon as a form of moral dialogue in modern society. Thus, the philosophical elucidation raises interesting problems about the role of the concept in our social life. But rather than pursuing these at this stage, we must instead return to the Greeks. The crucial point for the immediate discussion is that it may now be clearer why we could not use the moral words which express the modern concept of duty in translating Greek moral words. For these retain the connection with the vocabulary of desire in terms of which they can be made intelligible. The function of evaluative terms in Greek is, then, to grade different possibilities of conduct in terms of our desires, but in terms of which of our desires. Both Plato and Aristotle criticize the simple sophistic picture of human desires. We have to ask not only what we do now in fact happen to want, but what in the long run and fundamentally we want to want. And this implies a picture of man made explicit in different ways in both Plato and Aristotle, in which certain satisfactions are objectively higher than others. The use of the word objectively implies the existence of an impersonal, unchosen criterion. What is it? That there is some such criterion follows from treating the question, what is the good for man, or even just what is good for man, as an intelligible question at all. For unless there is some criterion by which to judge between possible answers, all possible replies are on a level and the question ceases to have point. It does not, of course, follow that there must be such a criterion or criteria, but only that the question and the criterion stand or fall together. Plato's transcendentalism springs in part from his grasp of this point. He believes that there must be a criterion. It cannot be derived from existing social structure and institutions, for we use our evaluative concepts to criticize these. It cannot be derived either from our desires just as they are, for we use our evaluative concepts to criticize and to grade our desires. Hence, it is easy to conclude that it must be derived from an order existing apart from human life as it is. Where Plato sees the criterion as transcendent, Aristotle sees it as embedded in one particular sort of practice and social arrangement. Both assume that if the chain of justifications which are constituted by answers to questions about the good for man is to be a chain of rational arguments, there must be essentially only one such chain, and there must be one essential point at which it reaches a final conclusion. The vision of the form of the good, or eudaimonistic contemplation. This is, of course, a mistake, and it is a mistake which both Plato and Aristotle make because they do not understand the conditions which have to be satisfied for there to be available the kind of criteria, the existence of which they take for granted, even if they are sometimes in doubt as to their precise nature. If I treat any form of inquiry as rational, I presuppose that there is some criterion by which to determine whether the answers to its questions are correct or incorrect. In speaking of a criterion, I speak of a standard which the individual is not free to accept or reject as he wills or chooses. He may reject a given criterion on rational grounds, such as that its falsity is entailed by some more fundamental or more generally applicable criterion, or he may find the proposed criterion unintelligible upon closer scrutiny. Consider two quite different kinds of example. Arithmetic is a rational because rule governed discipline. The rules which govern simple arithmetical operations enable us to determine whether the answer to a given sum is correct or incorrect. Anyone who understands the meaning of the words 1, 2, plus, equals, and 3 has no choice over whether to admit the truth of 1 plus 2 equals 3. But a condition of there being an agreed meaning for the words in question is that there should be a socially established practice of counting. We can imagine a tribe lacking number concepts because they lack the practice of counting. I do not mean by this that counting as a social, teachable practice is logically prior to the possession of number concepts, for counting itself in turn presupposes such possession. But I can only appeal to a rule to settle a disputed arithmetical question in a community where number concepts are intelligible, and they will only be intelligible where counting is an established and recognized practice. Consider now how similar evaluative terms are, in this one respect at least, to arithmetical. We are more accustomed to think of arithmetic as a rational discipline than we are of the criticism of cricket and football, chess and bridge. This is partly because in our study of Greek culture, we usually overrate Plato and underrate the Olympic Games, about which we could learn from Lucian. Plato thinks of gymnastic, of games playing, as merely a means to an end, as part of an educational discipline whose point lies in a final end product of a quite different kind. This is also the doctrine of the English public schools, for whom the point of games is that they produced character. But a study of the concepts used in the criticism of games for their own sake is philosophically revealing, even about Plato. Consider the concept of a good batsman. The questions of whether a batsman is a good batsman and how good a batsman he is are intelligible because there are established criteria. Variety of strokes, ability to improvise, moral stamina in crisis. We have these criteria because we have criteria of success or failure in cricket in general and in the role of a batsman in particular. And the winning of matches is not, of course, the sole criterion. How you win them also enters into it. But these criteria can only be appealed to because there is an established practice of games playing and can only be appealed to by those who share the social life in which this practice is established. Imagine a people who did not share the concept of a game and therefore could not acquire the relevant criteria. All that they would and could grasp would be that the word good was generally being used in contexts where approval of some sort was being indicated. Their philosophers would naturally enough construct theories about the meaning of good to the effect that it's used to express approval. And these theories would necessarily miss a large part of the point. In Greek ethics, something analogous to this imagined situation actually occurs. We begin with a society in which the use of evaluative words is tied to the notion of the fulfillment of a socially established role. We can indeed imagine a society of which this is true in a far stronger sense than it is of the imaginary society depicted in or the real societies reflected in the Homeric poems. Here the nouns and verbs to which evaluative adjectives and adverbs are attached would always invariably be those which name roles and role-fulfilling activities. In consequence, all the uses of good will belong with that class of adjectives whose meaning and force are dependent upon the meaning of the noun or noun phrase to which they are attached. We can understand this class by contrasting it with the class of adjectives whose meaning and force is not so dependent. Such are, for example, color words. We can render them meaningless by attaching them to a noun or noun phrase which cannot allow them any sense if it is used with its normal meaning. Consider pink rational number. But when they are attached to any noun in such a way as to form a meaningful phrase, their meaning is independent of that of the noun. Because of this, I can in such cases validly deduce from this is an XY, both this is an X and this is a Y. So from this is a red book, it follows that this is red and this is a book. But there are also the adjectives of which this is not true, where the force of the adjective is dependent upon the meaning of the particular noun to which it is attached, because the criteria for the correct application of the adjective vary with and are determined by the meaning of the noun. Such is good in those uses which connect with role fulfillment. The criteria for the correct application of the expressions good shepherd and good general and good flautist are determined by the criteria for the application of the expressions shepherd, general, and flautist. In learning how to describe social life, one also learns how to evaluate it. Moreover, there are a variety of uses of good where such impersonal and objective criteria can be found. Good at, used of skills, and good for, used of medicines or instruments, of means efficient for given ends, are two examples. In a society restricted to these uses, all evaluation would be a matter of the application of criteria about which the individual was not free to exercise choice. Such a society's evaluative usage resembles the usage of those who criticized performances in a game. In both cases, there are accepted standards. In both cases, to acquire the vocabulary necessary to describe and to understand the game is logically inseparable from acquiring these standards. In both cases, the fact that the standards are objective and impersonal is consistent with evaluative disagreements and even with disagreements which are incapable of resolution. This is because there are a number of criteria in terms of which we judge performances or exercises of ability and not just one single criterion for each role or skill. So we may, in evaluating a batsman, differ in the weight that we give to ability to improvise as against the possession of a particular stroke, and in evaluating a general, differ in the weight we give to ability to organize supply lines as against tactical brilliance on the field. Such as in the case of the criticisms of games, we could imagine a social group in which the use of evaluative words was lost, so we can imagine a society in which traditional roles no longer exist and the consequent evaluative criteria are no longer used, but the evaluative words survive. In both cases, all that remains of evaluation is the sense of approval attached to the words. The words become used as signs that the individual speaker is indicating his tastes, preferences, and choices. If we conceived of philosophical analysis as an analysis of how different concepts are, in fact, used in common speech, as a study of the logical features of usage, then we might well fall into an interesting trap at this point. For if we were to insist upon treating as the meaning of the word good only features of its use which were present on every occasion of its use, then we should naturally conclude that the essential meaning of the word is given by laying down its function of commanding or expressing approval or indicating choice or preference and so on, and that its association with criteria of an impersonal and objective kind is secondary, contingent, and accidental. Or we might fall into the opposite trap of supposing that, since the word good is in many standard cases only used intelligibly if it is applied in accordance with impersonal and objective criteria, all uses in which it is divorced from such criteria are too unimportant to be taken seriously. In fact, however, unless we see these two uses as constituting two successive phases in a historical narrative, we shall miss a large part of the point about the word good. When I speak of a historical narrative, I mean one in which the later part is unintelligible until the former is supplied, and in which we have not understood the former until we see that what followed it was a possible sequel to what had gone before. The use of the word good, when it is used only or primarily as an expression of approval or choice, is unintelligible except as a survival from a period when criteria of an impersonal, unchosen kind governed its use, because it has no distinctive use or function to distinguish it from a simple imperative or expression of approval. What would be being said when something is called good would be no more or other than would be said by someone who said, choose one of that kind, or that is the kind I prefer. The apparent redundancy of good might be explained away by pointing to its propagandistic possibilities. The use of the word good actually says no more than is said by the man who straightforwardly announces his choice or preference, but a man may contrive to give the impression of saying more, and by so doing attach prestige to his announcement by the use of good. Good is a status symbol for expressions of choice on this view. But this theory, in fact, discloses its own weakness. For why should good have this kind of status? Why should it carry this type of prestige? The answer can only be that it carries with it a distinction derived from its past, that it suggests a connection between the speaker's individual choices and preferences and with what anyone would choose, between my choice and the choice which the relevant criteria dictate. It would be equally mistaken, however, to suppose that the word good could not become detached from the particular criteria which have governed its use and still remain intelligible. What gives the word good its generality is partly the fact that a connection with choice and preference is present from the outset. To call something good is to say that anyone who wanted something of that kind would be satisfied with this particular specimen. We bring into the picture more than our own individual choice and preference. We point to more than our own individual choice and preference. We point to a norm for choice. And in a society where traditional roles and the corresponding traditional evaluation of behavior have broken down or disappeared, the sequel to unsuccessful attempts to use the word good as a simple expression of choice or preference may well be attempt to re-establish norms for choice. And there is no reason at all why good should not acquire new criteria of application. I have tried to delineate in the argument so far an ideal historical sequence. Such a sequence is useful for two different types of reason. It brings out the connection between historical intelligibility and logical relationships. I cannot understand the logical structure of a given philosophical theory, for example, unless I understand the problems to which it is intended to be a solution. But in a great many instances, I cannot hope to understand what those problems are unless I know what problems were posed by the philosophical predecessors of the theory and how the historical context imposes limits upon solutions to their problems. It is always possible and usually useful to abstract both problem and solution, question and answer, from their particular context and to examine matters of logic without too much reference to their actual history. This is what idealist philosophers, and particularly R. G. Collingwood, sometimes failed to see. But what they succeeded in seeing and saying on this point is more illuminating than most later writing. But more than this, the concepts which furnish the materials for philosophical investigation are, as we have already noticed, liable to change. Thus, what may appear at first misleadingly as two rival elucidations of the same concept, between which we have to choose, may be envisaged more usefully as two successive analyses of a concept in process of transformation, between which there is no question of a choice. Both are needed, and so is their interrelationship, so that we may not lose sight both of the continuity and of the change in the concept. Moreover, to analyze concepts in terms of ideal historical sequences may be useful for another reason. In abstracting certain characteristics of the sequence and thus lending it an ideal character, we acquire a method for noting similar sequences embedded in quite different historical processes. And in noting similarity, we may also note differences. Consider both the resemblances and the differences between what happened to agathos in Greek usage and what happened to duty in English. Just as agathos is originally tied to performance of a role, so is duty. We still talk of the duties of a policeman or a probation officer, and in a society where the moral life is exhaustively conceived in terms of role description, the duties of a father or a king may be as vigorously delimited by custom as those are which are now defined by statute. It is when we detach a man from his roles but still leave him with the concept of duty that the concept is necessarily transformed. This detachment is a consequence of a sufficiently radical change in established social structure and does not have to occur to a whole society all at once in a once-for-all kind of way. It can occur for part of a society, and it will occur in such a way as to be modified by other moral beliefs. So, for part of English society in the 18th century, the concept of duty became generalized in association with the concept of vocation. Originally, we have a society of well-defined occupational roles and functions, hierarchically arranged, and to this arrangement there corresponds a belief in different stations in life to which God is pleased to call man. When the occupational roles become more important, the notion of a calling by God, but not to any one particular station, remains. The duties which were tied to a particular office are replaced by the duty one owes to God simply as a man. In such a situation, the content of duty will be blurred. This kind of situation provides part of the background to the kind of moral dilemma which is examined in some of Jane Austen's novels. Her characters cannot simply conceive of morality in terms of the adequate fulfillment of a well-established role. Edmund Bertram in Mansfield Park can be open to Mary Crawford's criticism of his intention to become a clergyman. He can be forced to ask himself whether it will make him more or less of a man. Being a landowner and being in trade no longer carry a sense of clearly defined status in the hierarchy of duties. That this is so is highlighted by one remarkable exception. The person of the naval officer provides a touchstone of virtue in Jane Austen precisely because of his professionalized sense of duty, and she is able to speak of duty in this context far more clearly than elsewhere because the link between duty and duties has not been broken. The history of agathos in Greek and of duty in English or German are of course as different as the history of the breakdown of traditional Greek society is from the history of the transformations of pre-industrial England. But in both cases we get a move from the well-defined simplicities of the morality of role fulfillment, where we judge a man as farmer, as king, as father, to the point at which evaluation has become detached, both in the vocabulary and in practice, from roles, and we ask not what it is to be good at or for this or that role or skill, but just what it is to be a good man, not what it is to do one's duty as clergyman or landowner, but as a man. The notion of norms for men emerges as the natural sequel to this process and opens new possibilities and new dangers. At this point, however, does not the argument involve us in apparent paradox? We can understand why Plato and Aristotle, and why in the later context, Price and Kant, look for norms independent of the structure of this or that particular social framework. But the cost of doing this is to suggest the truth of exactly the kind of relativism which they were seeking to overcome. If the kind of evaluative question we can raise about ourselves and our actions depends upon the kind of social structure of which we are part and the consequent range of possibilities for the description of ourselves and others, does this not entail that there are no evaluative truths about man, about human life as such? Are we not doomed to historical and social relativism?